バラすわよ。
Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and cultural program of the African Sisters Media Network. And that was a prayer for Esu Legba, opening prayer for the Keeper of the Crossroads. And that was Zion Trinity singing that lovely, lovely prayer. And today we are going to be speaking with Kevin Legron, playwright, and Daryl V. Jones, director of The Legend of Pink, which is having a wonderful sage reading at Theater Rhinoceros in cooperation with the Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgender History Museum. And I was just thinking, Kevin, Daryl just joined us, that perhaps, you know, maybe we could talk a little bit about West Oakland, which is the setting for this great play. You could tell us what it's about, because presently West Oakland is in the news because there was a really horrific fire there Monday morning, and a lot of people, I think four people were killed, and everyone is displaced. And, you know, just sort of thinking about these fires in Oakland. And you've written a lot about you know, one of the fires, the one that happened last year, the Ghost Ship fire, and, you know, the artists that were, as you write, you know, partying, you know, when the fire happened. And then these people, you know, who were sleeping, you know, and it was so interesting that the fire department had been by the building on the 24th and found that it was not suitable because of all of the violations. And then on the 27th, the people, you know, goes up in smoke.
Oh, so yeah, anyway, that's very sad. You know, I think that we live in a situation that, you know, people are living in conditions that is not unhealthy, unsafe, you know, and this, you know, come to fruition.
So, welcome, Daryl. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you? Well, I guess
good.
I don't sound too good. A little bit of a cold, but other than that.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, hopefully, you know, by next week, you know, when the, I know you've been working really hard, you know, your full-time job at Cal State East Bay, and then, you know, you've been, you know, you're directing this wonderful, you know, reading of Kevin's play. And I just seen some of the pictures of the cast. It's going to be simply phenomenal. And I don't know if you're also acting in anything, but you are like a busy, busy man.
I am a busy, busy man. I am acting. The next thing is I am in. I am the old drag queen in Priscilla, the musical that they're doing at Theater Rhino next. So I am,
I'm with
yes.
you, Dad.
That's my next...
The old drag queen. Wow.
Well, I say the old drag queen. It's the oldest of the three. There are three that go on this journey through the desert, and I am the senior member.
Okay.
But...
Wow, well, I... but...
But we... But that's not happening yet, so let's get to Pink.
Sure. So, Kevin, tell us about Pink. Tell us, you know, the story of Pink and how you came to write it. I was sort of laughing when you you say that it was inspired by a close relationship with a transgender person and your own experience
that I lived with
as a middle class African American boy growing up in the diverse, in quotation marks, and progressive Bay Area.
Yeah, I used to live in East Oakland, and I was living there with my cousin. My cousin's a drag queen, and we lived there, you know, for a while. And all of a sudden, all my friends were drag queens. And I just, the story just came from that, the gentrification in West Oakland and how, like, you know, living in East Oakland, there was so much going on. But when you lived outside of East Oakland and you read about East Oakland or West Oakland or Oakland period, you know, it was like, everything was negative, everything was bad. Only bad people lived there, only bad things happened there. And then, but once you were in there, you know, it was just so much excitement, so much fun. And so that was where a lot of the legend of Pink comes from. It was that excitement, how Pink creates her own world, you know, within that so-called bad area.
So we'll come back and talk about some of the themes, you know, like class and father-son relationships that you bring up, you know, in your work. But Daryl, tell us about your take on The Legend of Pink and who you're working with to bring this work into, you know, make it alive, come alive for us off the page.
Well, let's see. As we speak, I'm getting information from actors about something. My take of Pink, well, you know, it's interesting. The story touches a lot of my personal experience, too. I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail. But I can say this. There was that epidemic that happened in the late 80s, maybe earlier than the late 80s, but of, you know, the whole wave of crack cocaine just shutting down neighborhoods. I mean, there were blocks and blocks. And by the way, I don't know if Kevin just mentioned, but the story takes place. Pink lives in the basement of an old Victorian house in the Oakland area, and upstairs there are drug dealers, you know, running their business. And what happens ultimately is someone from outside of the commune of that world ventures into that world, as is often the case when people are looking for their drug or whatever. They oftentimes find themselves in situations where they would never be, and it unfortunately it doesn't go well for this person. But you know, I can remember a time of driving through Oakland, not too far from where I live, and I have to say I live where this play takes place. But where
oh,
you,
you
would
do.
Just
wow,
yeah,
I do.
Did you take that picture, Daryl?
No, I didn't take that picture. I didn't take that picture. I'm not a huge fan of that picture.
Me either.
I don't really know what the picture doesn't have a whole lot to do with the play. But no, I didn't take that picture. So I can remember a time when you would drive by these neighborhoods in West Oakland at night and at whatever, and there would just be these open air drug markets. And all these young boys out on the streets just hustling away, you know, selling these drugs. And cars would just pull up, car after car after car. So that was a very real reality. And fortunately, what has happened over time is that that has gone away. I can remember very specific spots where you could see this, and it's gone, and I am so glad that it's gone. But you know, I often wonder, well, where did all those kids go? They've moved somewhere. Something has changed, or is it all done undercover now? But also there's been this huge gentrification, and whenever there's a gentrification, something is lost. You know, there's a culture that's lost. There's the people that were there originally, somehow they suffer. And, you know, this fire that happened last week, that too is not too far from where I live. That's a little further from where I live. I live in what they call the bottom. And the bottom is old section of West Oakland. I live near the train. I live in the gentrified townhouses that were built next to the old train station. But, you know, I think about that fire, and that's a result of the gentrification in a way, because people just don't have any place else to live in Oakland. The housing crisis is really a crisis, but the thing is that people's pockets are being lined with, you know, the amount of money that they can, you know, make off of new housing that they're charging $800,000 for, and the other people are just being ignored and pushed to the side. So I think I got off track here, but in the story, while that's certainly one of the things, one of the themes that is touched on in the play, the price of gentrification. There are many others. In the story itself, there's this interesting love story between Pink and Ace. And it's like this. It's a very interesting love story. Their relationship is. It's a non-traditional gay relationship, although they wouldn't say it's a gay relationship. It's a non-traditional relationship between two men who love each other.
They love each other.
Yes, they do love each other. And so that's part of it. And then you've got the story of Bradford Deshawn. He has two names. I'm not going to tell you why he has two names. And how he gets involved in this world and what. So I think it's a real slice of what living in that area was like at that time. It's set in 1989. I have to say that I don't think that it's limited to 1989. I think it could have been set in the 2000s. I think it's not that far removed from the experience now, although we do have to see that things have changed through the gentrification. I'm done.
I want to let our audience know that The Legend of Pink, written by playwright Kevin Legrone and directed by Daryl V. Jones, our guest this morning, is being having its stage reading on Monday, April 3rd at 7 p.m. at the Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgender History Museum in San Francisco, 4127 18th Street. Is that up for many BART stations, or do you catch the trolley? What's near there?
You got to take the trolley, like, you know, one of the undergrounds, whatever, to Castro Street exit, and then get off from there.
Okay. I know exactly where that is. Is that in the new center that they built? That's really nice along Market Street.
No. You have to actually go to the Castro Street exit, get off the Castro Street exit, and then come upstairs and then maybe walk a couple of blocks. Mm-hmm. If it's the same place I'm thinking about, that's a crack place right there. It's on the 18th Street.
Okay, yeah. So it's near the Castro Theater then.
Yeah, across the street from where the Pendulum used to be.
Okay, all right. Okay, cool. So Kevin, Tell us a little bit more about the play, some of the themes that are running through it. You mentioned that in the past, the outsiders, even city officials, acted as if Oakland was a ghost town, and that's interesting.
Right.
You know that that you know that term ghost town comes up, and so you say that they just weren't a part of the community's vibrancy and liveliness, and so they couldn't
mm-hmm.
see it. They just saw mm-hmm. the negative portrayal in the media. And and so through your character Pink, you know, and the people and the boys, you know, that she kind of mentors and her friend and lover, you know, you sort of give it a different, you know, these are the people you don't know, so to speak. And as Daryl was mentioning, you know, these are the people that, you know, the politicians
really
probably still don't know.
They really live there.
It's
really
true.
There.
We still don't know them.
Exactly.
Right.
And the thing is,
yeah.
when you live outside the area, you know, you read the media, you know, and they always focus on the negative things, the negativity. And they don't, because they don't go inside and see the actual people living there, they don't really see the beauty of the culture. And I think that as black people, we really go through that a lot because mainstream media kind of stereotypes us. Like, for example, you got the gangster rap, which, you know, really has very little to do with us. But now it represents us. It symbolizes black culture. If you go all over the world, it's black culture, you know?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So talk about... you know, some of the themes, you know, that sort of come up in the work. Because you can't ignore Pink. You know, Pink has a presence.
The thing is, the area was underground. And the whole world was underground. So everyone who comes into the to that world, they come into the underground. So they're basically hiding. No one wants to be seen. But Pink is in the underground, and she's the only one who, you know, is flamboyant or, you know, expressing herself through her art. And so therefore, she gets all the attention. But everyone is just, you know, is just as important as Pink in that world. That makes sense. And so then, you know, you talk about other themes. For example, one of the themes is that we see each other through our own stereotypes. Therefore, like, say, you go into a community and they see you through how they want to see you, and they, you know, and they may not really see who you really are. And, you know, and all the characters in the play basically deal with that, okay? Another issue was the father-son thing and the issue of trust, because the lack of trust in, you know, that Pink had, you know, you kind of go through the world distrusting other people, and that, so you have a distrust in your own relationship, and that sours your own relationship. Yes, I was talking about that as well.
Can I pipe in here? When he was talking about Pink being flamboyant one in this community, and there's something else that happens in the play, and this is perhaps the more obvious aspect, but, you know, it's not so much this way in West Oakland now, and that is a good thing. But there's also these drug dealers have managed to control how everyone in the community is functioning around them.
Yes.
You know, how the people in the church, you know, are, everybody knows that they're there, but nobody wants to say anything, and everybody's very cautious because no one wants to get involved, and or not involved. No one wants to, you know, suffer the repercussions of actually confronting them. So there's this aspect of how they can move into a community and really suck the instill so much fear and keep people hostage in a way. And Pink has an interesting relationship with the father because her father is part of the church. And I don't want to give too much away.
You already did.
I did? Oh, well.
Yeah.
But you'll have to come and see how that plays out.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. You know, it's interesting when you mentioned that, you know, the relationship between, you know, Pink and her dad. I was just thinking about James Baldwin and his father and that contentious relationship. Do either of you or both of you see any parallels there? Because I know, Daryl, you also mentioned, you know, the recent award-winning film Moonlight, and that you mentioned it in relationship to the environment of oppression. And you think about sort of how being forced underground, you know, it can actually be turned into something creative, which is how it comes out in Pink, as opposed to, you know, sort of something negative. But anyway, I was wondering about the Baldwin connection and his dad. Do you see any connection there, either of you?
Well, I'll let Daryl talk.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that I didn't really think about James Baldwin when I wrote that, and I didn't have that connection. So Daryl might have had, maybe Daryl did. I don't know.
Now that it's finished, do you see? Because I see, you know, when you think about sort of James Baldwin's father, you know, he was really harsh, you know, toward his son, and that's why James Baldwin had to leave when he was a teenager, because his father, you know, was really close to enslavement. I don't know if he had been enslaved. He might have been. There were only a few ways to be successful and to get out of the place that, you know, white America had for black people. Like, this is the only place you can be. So make it work. You know, and Baldwin, you know, he tried the church, but it just wasn't working for him. You know, he called it his gimmick. You know, and it's like, and he just felt, you know, I don't know, it just felt unethical to him. So anyway, Daryl?
Well, it wasn't who he couldn't be his authentic self in the church. And if anybody was going to be their authentic self, it was James Baldwin. He was not going to deny his homosexuality. He didn't believe that he was going to go to hell because of it, or maybe he did, but whether he did or not, he had to be who he was. I hadn't thought about any particular parallels, but I think that it's a common, a common story for African American, gay and lesbian people, that oftentimes their families, that sometimes due to church-based faith, do not accept them. I think that's changing. And I think, too, in the case of Pink, it's not just, you know, Pink was not just homosexual, but Pink is a drag queen. So that there's an extra thing that the father had to accept. I don't know that the father would have accepted his son being homosexual, but being a drag queen, that's a harder leap. I feel like I'm giving way too much away. I need to to be quiet.
Well, you know, but I'll say that, but I will say this though. I love having my play discussed. Because you always I was hearing about, you know, other plays being discussed and everything and discussed seriously. So I am honored. I'm loving this. I'll be honest. My ego is just way up there.
Oh, good.
Oh, that's good. Good, Kevin. That's awesome.
Well, Kevin, when we are done, you need to call me because we have a crisis brewing. So.
Okay.
Not a crisis. We just have a small little thing we have to settle.
Okay.
Let
me say this right quick.
Yeah.
Because now, one thing about Pink, Pink is not an activist, and Pink is not trying to change the world or whatever. Pink is just being Pink.
Yeah.
And I think that is part of the fun of Pink. You know, Pink is just having fun as who she is, as where she is, and, you know, and enjoying what she wants and doing what she wants to do. And I think that is part of the fun of Pink, because Pink is not making a statement to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of frees her in a lot of ways, because she can just really do what she really wants to do. And she's not trying to, like, you know, change or alter, just being Pink in that her own little world. She's created her world, and that's the world that she, you know, that is her world.
So for our audience that's not quite aware of what a drag queen is, what's a drag queen? And and how did Pink come to her name, Pink? She likes pink clothes, or
she likes pink. She loves pink. She loves the color pink. And in the play, you'll see that she just loves that color pink. That's where it comes from. She just loves pink.
Okay.
You know, but
anyone that's not familiar with what a drag queen is, they need to watch
RuPaul's
drag show. But go on. I'll let you describe what a drag queen is.
Well, okay. First of all, my definition was based on, like, say, 1989, back in the past, not today, because today I know we've gone through all these new terms, you know. And so back in those days, basically a drag queen was just a very broad term for, you know, a man who dressed up as a, you know, as a woman, okay? And it could be anything from living your life full-time that way, or just doing it part-time that way. Maybe sometimes people did it just when they performed on stage. Some people lived their lives full-time that way. And so back then, that term was just used to cover all that. Now we have different, you know, definitions. And so Pink is basically a boy, but it's dressed up as a woman and it has fun playing with it. And it's still kind of new to Pink. It's still kind of new to Pink. It's a fun new lifestyle. Pink is young.
How old is Pink?
She's about, I think, about 21, in that age range.
Okay.
Early 20s, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And in closing, you know, we haven't had a chance, Daryl, to talk about your cast. So tell us who's portraying Pink and how, you know, rounded out, you know, by the other members of Pink's world.
Pink is Gabriel De Leon, Gabriel Christian, sorry, Gabriel Christian, who played Ochusi in The Brother Size, the production that I did at Theater Rhino. And Bradford DeShawn is one of my students here at Cal State East Bay. His name is Sean Scott. Sean did very well at the Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival, Region 7, last month. He was one of the finalists. And
wow.
Then Nikki... excuse me, is also one of my students from Cal State East Bay. I don't know, Wanda, if you came to see Follow Me to Nelly's when I did that here. I think you might have missed that. But she was lovely. She was the young ingenue lead in that, and she was fabulous. So she's on board. And then Ace is supposed to be Lakeitrick Kimberly, who was Ogun in The Brother's Size. But we're having... There might be a cast. There might be a shift in the cast by the time it goes up on Monday. I'm not quite sure.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Daryl, and I'm not boycotting. You know, your wonderful programs at Cal State East Bay. I just never hear about them. So.
I know. Oh no. Well, this was a while ago. This was. Yeah. But no, I know you're not boycotting.
I will inform you.
I'm
in a play there. Yeah, I would love to come see your work because, I mean, that's what you do, musical theater.
That's
and I know
I
you
do.
Have a show. I think I don't know if you have more than one show a year, but I know that you do regular, you know, performances there. So, yeah, I think I've seen two. They were both awesome, very excellent. Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, hopefully you will work out, you know, what's going on there. And it sounds, yeah, I'm sure you'll be able to figure it out creatively because that's what you do. You're creative people. And,
we'll figure it out.
Yeah, yeah. And lastly, Kevin, you write in a number of genres. You write essays. You do literary journalism. You curate art exhibits. You got one getting ready to happen. When is that one, the new one, coming up at the library in San Francisco?
It starts in June, and it's called My Art Makes My Life Matter, which is, I guess, connected to Pink, because Pink's art makes her life matter. So I guess I'm doing the same thing with this particular exhibit. And it's it was inspired by Black Lives Matter, because basically, you see, Black Lives Matter, you know, like, what does that mean, you know? And especially in San Francisco, you know, being from the Bay Area, you know, what does being Black mean where we're so marginalized? And so basically, artists answer that question by saying, well, my art makes my life matter. And they just tell how they do it, how it happens.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It's in June.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So, is this your first play being staged in a reading?
My first full-length play. I've had one-man, one-act plays produced. I've had scripts made to videos, of film and videos and stuff like that in school and when I got to school. And so in terms of a full-length play, yes, it's my first one.
Oh, great. Yeah, well, congratulations. I hope to follow
James Baldwin. I hope to follow James Baldwin. I hope to follow James Baldwin.
Yeah, that's a big ambition. Yeah. Well, you know, you're young. You got time.
We'll see.
But definitely, huh?
We'll see.
Say that. Yeah. Wow. I'm glad you all are still with us in time to be able to say hi to Jewel, who is her last few shows, you know, Leaving the Blues at New Conservatory Theater Center are selling out. So let's say hi to Jewel. Good morning, Jewel. How are you?
Hi, Jewel.
I wanted you to Daryl Jones and Kevin Legrone. They were talking about a stage reading of Kevin's play on Monday, and I told Kevin that you were going to be joining me to talk about your world premiere of Leaving the Blues, you know, play with music about blues legend Alberta Hunter that closed a Sunday. And so I just wanted you all to be able to say hi to each other and congratulations and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, congratulations. Having a reading is so exciting.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Thank
yes,
you. I'm very excited. You know, I'm very excited to have Daryl do it.
I think one of my students is in, I know one of my students is in the play, Jasmine Williams.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. She's so wonderful. It's been really, really great to work with her. She's got such presence and charisma and a fabulous voice. You know, I appreciate her so much. Thank you.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and, you know, working with a cast, how important it is to have a good collective spirit. And I will say that is one of the most exciting things about this production for me is this cast is like this ball of energy that's holding together so well. They all have that spirit that contributes to the piece in this major, major way and showcases their talents. It's been a real great experience, and Jasmine is right at the heart of that.
Cool.
Particularly
since
she gets to play two opposing characters. You know, one young, sweet, ingenue singer, and the other a kind of, you know, high yellow, attitudinal bad girl. She gets to play the full range.
Well, that's great. I'm glad she is doing well. I'm pleased to hear it. That is great. I had been hoping to get to see the production, but I was very sick last week, but maybe I'll get in this weekend.
Yeah, you got to get there this weekend because it's closing and on Sunday.
I know.
Sunday matinee.
I know.
And where is it?
New Conservatory.
Which is Civic Center.
Oh.
And to be honest with you, the only nights that have tickets are tonight and Friday. The other shows are sold out.
Well, Friday sold out.
Yeah.
Tonight at 8 o'clock. Tomorrow there's live music from Mr. Tipples, so you know people want to get their groove on. So it's sold out. And then Friday, is Friday sold out too, Jill? Because I see
no
Friday
have seats. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And Sunday has seats. I believe 2 p.m. matinee.
Right.
So you mean that your fingers do you the walking? Yeah, get your tickets now.
All right, I have to run.
Well, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
No problem. Good talking to you, Daryl.
Great to
talk
to you.
Thank you, Kevin, for joining us.
All right.
And
take care. Bye bye.
And thank you both. Bye bye. Bye bye.
Bye. Wow, Jill, we're having our conversation. I'm so excited.
I know.
Yeah, it's been a long time from when I came to the preview the day before the opening. This play is really gotten a lot of good traction because the story is so phenomenal. You know, a blues singer, Alberta Hunter, and the way you tell it, you know, reimagining her and her life, and as you mentioned, you know, the ensemble is stunning, you know, especially the actress Desiree Rogers as Alberta, but you know it's everyone that sort of makes, you know, the story come alive the way it does. Let me read your bio, and then we could talk about the play Leaving the Blues, and which is kind of a metaphor, Leaving the Blues, because blues is it has a lot of connotations and people might not be able to unpack them, but you do in the work. So Jill Gomez, a playwright, is also the author of Waiting for Giovanni, a play about James Baldwin, which premiered at the New Conservatory Theater Center in 2011, and I was there at the reading as a part of Afro Solo at the African American Art and Culture Complex, and I saw it at the New Conservatory Theater Center, and it was excellent because I love James Baldwin. Jill is also the author of 8 books, including the cult favorite black lesbian vampire novel, The Gilda Stories. Yeah, and what's the anniversary for the Guild? So was it 25th anniversary last year?
Yeah, this 2016 was the 25th anniversary of the Guild of Stories, and City Lights Books did a new edition, a brand new edition with a new introduction and an afterword. And I did a book tour in the spring. And so it's like launching a new book because it's a whole new generation of people who've never met Gilda. So this has been a fun year.
Right. Yeah. I got a copy of that new edition and didn't get a chance to talk to you when you were on tour. But I remember, you know, reading the Gilda Tales, the Gilda Stories, and also being your student at Mama Bear's. And when the Gilda Stories, you know, met Urban Bushwomen at your Buena Center for the Arts Theater.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm scared of vampires, Jewel. What am I going to do? I want to go see the play. And you said, you can do it, Wanda. They're vampires, but you'll be able to handle it. So I trusted you and I went. And it was marvelous. I still remember being in that auditorium. I can still feel some of the energies from that. That was a long time ago, and it was amazing.
Yeah, that was a while ago. And that was where I worked on the Gilda play for about 3 years, and one of the people who I worked with was Toshi Reagan, who did all of the music for the Gilda play. And that's how we became friends. And then she wrote the closing song for the current play, Leaving the Blues. So it all comes around in a circle.
Yeah, it does. It really does. And it's so interesting. 2 weeks ago, Toshi Reagan was here as a part of the Blues Project.
Yeah.
Here we are, you know, still singing those songs, you know, that come from our ancestors. And wow, this Alberta Hunter story is just so phenomenal. But let me finish with your bio here. So you're the winner of 2 Lambda Literary Awards for Gilda Stories. Your play Bones and Ash, which was based on the novel which you just mentioned, toured 13 cities. And you say, much thanks to Arturo Katrikala for guiding this train and to all those readings and provided feedback to the actors and technical artists. And I am reading from the profiles, and I'll let people get their own book when they go see the play. So make sure you get tickets for those few dates that are not sold out, because the theater is so lovely. It's intimate. I mean, you literally can touch shoulders with the person next to you, so it's like a family thing. It's really, really lovely. Yeah. So, Jewel, tell us about this story of Alberta Hunter and sort of why it called to you, you know, creatively to want to tell it the way you tell it, which is a little different from, you know, what we see if we read you know, her biography, autobiography, or saw the film, or saw the other play that was staged at San Jose Rep many years ago.
I was interested in Alberta from the moment I saw her singing at the Cookery in the 1980s. She was then in her 80s, and she was so vivacious and sharp and funny and charming, and this complexity of womanhood that I found her fascinating. So, you know, I went back to see her several times, and every time I went, the show was sold out. It was in a very small little restaurant. They had a very tiny stage. And I I took my grandmother once. My grandmother was visiting me from back home, Boston, and my grandmother had danced on the stage. She had been a chorus girl when she was younger, you know, in the same kind of period that Alberta had been on the stage. So I figured she would enjoy her. And so every time I went, there were a lot of young women there. So I said to my grandmother, "You see all these young women? It's interesting, isn't it? Do you know why they're here?" My grandma said, "No, why?" I said, "Well, they heard a rumor that Alberta is a lesbian." And my grandma said, "Oh, everybody knew that." And that to me was the beginning of a story of how she managed to make an international career for herself with such a big, quote-unquote, secret. You know, because she clearly made no reference to it in her shows. She was tried to be, her presentational self was very, it was a combination of both ladylike and bawdy. So she had a stage presence that acknowledged the bawdiness of some of the blues songs, but she always presented herself as someone somewhat removed from that kind of behavior. And so I was very curious about who was this person really. And I think many people, I'm not one of them, but many people have a very difficult time imagining older adults as having younger lives. You know, just like it's very difficult for young people to imagine their parents having sex or their grandparents having sex, I think it's very difficult for younger people to imagine that older people had lives as exciting and often way more exciting than their lives. So I was interested in trying to recreate the life that Alberta had when she was a young woman, when she had a lover, and how she would have managed that life, what it meant to her. And it was kind of like leading a double life. And I know that a lot of stars and people who wanted to be stars did that. You know, it wasn't just Rock Hudson, who was leading a double life in Hollywood. A lot of queer people were doing that. So I became fascinated, and it took me a while to get to her, but I finally did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just perfect, you know, that that this work is being you know, being presented now. You know, your run, you know, went all the way through, you know, International Women's History Month, which, you know, what a better representative of, you know, a free woman than Alberta Hunter. And the fact that you actually saw her, like, so it wasn't just research, you actually did you get a chance to talk to her at all when you were going to see her?
No, we never spoke. I mean, at that point, she was in her mid-80s, and it was, you know, her energy got used up a lot with her singing, and she was a very determined person. And what I have been able to do, as I was working on the play, I got to have a conversation with Chris Albertson, who is the biographer of Bessie Smith, and he wrote the biography Bessie, on which the Queen Latifah TV film, HBO film, was based. And Chris Albertson became friends with Alberta later in her life, and he is actually represented in the play as someone who recorded her, made recordings of her for the Smithsonian, and he has posted interviews with her on his website, and he's quite elderly himself now, but in his younger years he had a very an ongoing relationship with Alberta, and I got to talk with him about her a little bit, and that was wonderful because I got confirmation about a lot of the impressions that I had from watching her on stage. And the other thing that I did go to the Schomburg Library in New York, which houses her papers. And so that was revealing in a number of different ways for me as I did the writing. And, you know, some surprises that were very dear, you know, things that you just don't think about, personal things that were quite lovely. So and I tried to work them into the script to some degree to give her a rounded character, especially since so little has been written about her. A lot of the ideas or specifics in the play I fabricated to really round out the character and the times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, one of the themes that runs through the play is the relationship, mother-daughter relationship, and you know, light, dark, and how the character seems to feel, well, actually, with reason, that her mother is, you know, doesn't love her, but she doesn't let that keep her away from her mother. She still, you mentioned in the talk back at the preview that she did write letters, and I believe, you know, when you were reading her papers, those letters are there. Some of the letters, or I don't know, most of the letters are there. You were able to read that correspondence.
Well, she had, it was interesting, what Alberta left to the library, very little personal correspondence.
Oh, okay.
Very little personal, some, but not a lot. You know, a lot of cards and things like that. And I do give, you know, somewhat of an apology to Alberta's mother, because I think I may have made her a lot tougher on Alberta than she might have been. It's hard to know. Alberta has made mention that her mother was tough on her, and at the same time, Alberta took care of her mother for a very long time. So I don't actually know how much her mother's, how deep her mother's disapproval of her was. I really don't. I know that she was religious, and in that time it would make sense that her mother would not be necessarily approving of her singing those particular songs. But so a lot of that, as I said, I had to fabricate because I was interested in a couple of themes. And one of them was how people of color, African Americans, internalized racism and were colorists ourselves, you know. And I think it has been a common occurrence for people of color to treat each other poorly because one person is dark and one person is light, even though they're the same ethnicity. And I think this has been a cultural flaw that has gone down through the ages, and In some degree, it's inherited from colonizers. But, you know, I don't really know all of the reasons. But it seems to exist in many, many cultures. And certainly in the African-American culture, the tradition of dismissing people who are darker is really one of the character flaws of our culture. So I wanted to embody that, and what better way to embody it is to start with the mother as the one who instills that insecurity in Alberta around her skin tone, which then, of course, goes on to be reinforced by the culture around her. Literally, the reviewers in even the black newspapers occasionally made reference to Alberta's skin color being darker. So, you know, not only did she have to think about that with the white audiences and critics, the black audiences and critics were commenting on her skin color. So that's a lot to have to deal with, both growing up as a kid, but then once you put yourself on a stage, which is a very vulnerable position, to know that you're going to have to listen to that. You're going to have to face that denigrating attitude because you're not as light-skinned as Lena Horne, for example. So skin color became a theme for me in the play, and I, you know, started with Alberta, and then there's these two fictional characters I created, the Calabash cousins, and the idea that two cousins could travel around the country, or two boys would travel around the country and pass themselves off as cousins, even though one is white and one is black. And they could, of course, be cousins, but how people decide to see you, given a context. If you say you're black, and as we've seen recently with the NAACP executive director, if you say you're black, people will often accept you as black, no matter who you are.
Right.
So, and she's still claiming to be black, spiritually black, or whatever that is. That it's, you know, people will see what they want to see, in other words. And color is one of those complex things. Color is in the eye of the beholder, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. And the ancestors are really present, you know, in this particular work as well. You know, we have, you know, Michael Gene Sullivan's character, Will, and I wanted to mention that the Calabash cousins are portrayed by Paul Collins and Anthony Rollins Mullins, and really, really excellent. But the character Will, he's like an ingenue. He travels between the worlds, and he's like a ghost spirit, his spirit actually supports, you know, Alberta in a way that she needs support, you know, giving her courage when she might not feel it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really I love the character Will, and he, of course, is a tribute to Burt Williams, who was one of our most talented and pioneering singer comedians in vaudeville in the early part of the century, and Burt Williams was in fact the uncle of Alberta's longtime lover, Lottie Tyler. So I wanted to pay tribute. I wanted him to be in it in part because he was such a dynamic figure in our culture, but also because, as you said, the ancestors do play a big part in how we live our lives, even if we don't know who they are specifically. You know, I'm sure a lot of younger artists don't realize who Burt Williams was or who Alberta Hunter is, but the thread of their influence is always there. We can always, if we unpack, as they say, the work, find the layers of our history embedded in contemporary work. And Burt Williams is always one of those kind of, you know, tragic figures who lived a very big life and died too young. I mean, it would have been lovely to see who he would have been as an older performer, you know, with wisdom and seasoning. So I had fun writing him in and making him a combination of that old vaudeville, kind of makes fun of himself as the old black-faced vaudeville performer, and at the same time carries himself with a lot of dignity and knows more about the future than even Alberta does. And I wanted, one of the things that I created, or I actually didn't create, I commissioned from a local artist, Michael Ross, who's a lovely visual artist. I commissioned a church fan that Michael rendered beautifully, which has a drawing on one side of kind of a Burt Williams figure in blackface, and on the other side, like in many churches when you get a church fan, it has a picture of Dr. Martin Luther King on the other side, looking very beatific and elegant. But I asked Michael to make it a picture of Dr. King in the Montgomery jail, so that it is Dr. King, but it's a more complex vision of Dr. King than that heroic, traditional vision in the shirt and tie. And so that's Will's main prop in the play, is his fan that reflects the long journey of African Americans in this American culture.
Yeah, Michael does a really, really great job, as Will. And Will, he sort of straddles those places that make Alberta uncomfortable sometimes when he recites a poem or does a dance that you think, yeah, that's more stereotypical. Of the period, and it seems, you know, that, you know, he represents sometimes what Alberta is trying to avoid, and it's really great within the play that you have her traveling, you know, to Europe, but she still can't quite drop that mask even when she's away from America.
Yes, and yes, the mask is definitely another one of the themes of the play. How all of these, or all of us, in many ways, are trying to find who we are, and how we often construct these public masks that contain us in many ways, rather than reveals us. And, you know, in Europe, I tease with my producer, Ed, at New Conservatory Theater. Ed Decker is the producer and founder of the theater, and he also did the Baldwin play. And I teased with him and said, you know, my biographers, if I have any, in the future after I'm gone, will probably mention that Jewel has an obsession with writing scenes in Paris parties in her plays. And it's true. There is so much liveliness in that period in the early part of the 20th century when African Americans traveled to Europe and often found the kind of culture that they felt like they could be themselves. I don't want to say that it wasn't racist, because of course it was, but it was a culture that was discovering African-American culture. And so Black people felt like they could, as one of the characters in my play says, Black people could be people in Paris. And I think those scenes, anytime I write a scene in which a Black person goes to Europe, it's a signal to say we had bigger lives than simply what you know of us in the small lives you try to box us into in the United States. That there were other countries that found our contributions amazing. But then, of course, those other countries end up betraying their own principles. You know, if you look at France and its kind of semi-fascist history and its betrayal of the Africans who live there now, it's very sad. But that energy meant a lot to African American artists in the 20s and 30s and 40s. So that's why I always have a Paris scene in my play.
Yeah, and was Josephine Baker there when Alberta Hunter went, or was that their paths cross each other? Okay.
Oh yeah, definitely their paths crossed. We don't know how intimately their paths crossed. There are rumors, of course. And Alberta knew just about everybody, you know, Billie Holiday, and she was a big fan of Billie Holiday's, and really very, very, very upset at how Billie was treated by the New York Police Department. You know, that took away her license and really, really harassed her to her death. So it was a very internationally connected figure. And because she spanned so many years, it's, you know, it's exciting to think about her as a bridge herself, you know. When in one of the scenes in the play, I have her say she was thinking about reviving a song by the Supremes, and both the characters on stage are shocked, and I think the audience is too, and I did that deliberately because we forget there's so much overlapping of the past and the present that, I mean, Alberta Hunter was definitely alive and definitely could have been listening to the Supremes on the radio. So it's kind of wild when you think about, because you think about the past as being dead and in the past, when of course it's not, it's always with us, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Do you have time for a couple more questions?
Sure.
Okay,
sure.
Super. I wanted to ask you about sort of the relationship between Letty and Alberta. Letty loves Alberta. Letty is portrayed by Leontine Belly and Bung, and you change the story there to fit, you know, sort of the story that you're telling. But Letty is from a privileged background, and Alberta, you know, she had to work for everything. And you also change the age, you know, differential.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have, yeah. So that's really interesting too. Desiree told me that in reality, Lottie was older than Alberta.
Yeah.
But in the play, Alberta is older than Letty, and so that's interesting, the dynamic. But Letty is fair complexion than Alberta. And it's really interesting because you have the set is just marvelous, and we can see these beautiful prints, photographs, portraits of Alberta Hunter, and in the various stages of her life, and she's gorgeous, and it's like really they mm-hmm. said she was dark, mm-hmm. like she's not dark. I mean, I guess maybe I don't know. I guess in the American context, perhaps. Yeah, I was wondering if you could talk about that relationship. Because it is juxtaposed by, you know, by the Calabash twins' relationship. So that's nice having that polarity there, you know,
mm-hmm.
That story. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's really nice the way you do that.
Well, I'm glad you like it. It's very, taking liberties with people's life story is, you know, you take a chance, and my feeling has been there are certain kinds of dynamics, and I could have used the ones that existed, but they really, to tell the story I wanted to tell, the real Lottie was a couple of years older than Alberta, and I wanted to recreate it so that there was a way, because I think this was in fact true, that probably Alberta was driving the relationship. You know, it was Alberta's career. And apparently Lottie herself had a entertainment career. But I wanted to create a unified vision of a woman, Alberta, who's the one who's driven and needs to fashion and shape her image so that she could be the popular singer she wanted to be. And it made it more, the sharper contrast is if Letty was younger. And, you know, I only have seen one picture of Letty, Lottie Tyler, who Letty is based on, and in it she looks very elegant and upscale and is lighter skinned. And of course Will, who's based on Burt Williams was fairly light skinned himself. So I, in order to make the contrast between them, I made the Letty character younger. It's, you know, in theater you want your contrast to be sharp and dramatic, and so that's what I did with that. I wanted to create a romance that was passionate but had to live within the parameters of both the times, which were not going to be that liberal, and within the parameters of Alberta herself, her prescriptions against being exposed and her fears of being exposed. So it was within those parameters that I created their relationship. And I have no real sense of, you know, nobody really knows why they split up, although there is rumor that Lottie, the actual character, person, went off with a producer's wife. But I do know that apparently they remained friends for the rest of their lives until Lottie died. So I decided to make the conflict be more about what kind of openness that Lottie would want and what kind of silence Alberta would want to maintain. Because Alberta, just from looking at her papers and reading the biography about her, Alberta was very closed mouth. So I could see that as being a tension in any relationship. So that's how I developed the relationship between Letty and Alberta on stage, trying to create the character of Letty based on Lottie, but not completely using it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. At the talk that you gave opening, last preview the day before opening night, and since then you had a talk back, I think 2 weeks ago, this Sunday.
Yeah.
How was it?
It was lovely, and I must say, it's very gratifying when such a large number of people in the audience stay. Often for talkbacks, you know, if you get a third of the audience to stay for the talkback, it's fortunate. But with these two talkbacks we did, I would say probably, I don't know, 80% of the audience have stayed. And that has been really, really gratifying. We don't never have enough time for people's questions, but it has been quite gratifying because people really are engaged and moved and curious. And these are the important things. I mean, I want everybody to leave the play, go on YouTube and see Alberta and hear Alberta and buy her music and really come to know something about her and something about the period in which she lived, because it's exciting to see what women of color can accomplish in a period that was not kind to women of color, that objectified them and tried to keep them in the kitchen, other people's kitchens, not their own. So I feel like, you know, my work has been done.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I was wondering if we can come back to the whole idea of the blues, you know, as an archetype and as a metaphor for the sojourn of Black people, you know, in the diaspora, you know, post, you know, enslavement, during enslavement, and now, you know, because the blues are still here, and Alberta talks about the blues in the play, and I was wondering if you could talk about sort of that whole idea of the blues, and this wonderful woman, Alberta, who at a point stopped singing the blues, like, whoa, for a long time. You know, when she has another career,
yeah,
taking care of people, and
yeah,
you know, the nurse, that's an interesting story, you know, that Desiree shared with us last week on the show. Well, that's really something. And then you're in there, too. You know, you mentioned, you know, your grandmother that, you know, was visiting you. in New York, and you went to the Cookery, you know, to see Alberta Hunter perform, and, you know, and your grandmother's response. But then you talk about, you know, being raised by your grandmother. So I wonder if you could sort of, like, sort of weave those two together, the blues and Jewel Gomez and Alberta Hunter.
Well, you know, I think culturally, I mean, many people have written so much, but it is amazing that the slave culture was dependent on crushing African culture, you know, separating people so that different African tribal people couldn't talk to each other because they didn't speak the same languages, and separating them deliberately so they couldn't communicate, keeping Africans who were enslaved, keeping them from communicating, trying to crush their music, their singing, all of the things that a culture carries with it through time, the slave culture tried to crush. And interestingly enough, what happened was other cultural elements grew up out of it, so that drumming became a way of communicating. Even though slave masters tried to prevent that. And tap dancing came out of the percussive traditions and was a way to communicate. That while slave masters were trying to convert and insisting that slaves be Christians, and really used Christianity to keep black people enslaved during that period. But what African Americans ended up doing was creating a very different kind of musical tradition, spirituals, out of the kind of staid and European music of the Christian church. So it is fascinating. That's fascinating to me. And certainly blues, you know, evolving from the work songs that slaves used to keep time and keep count. And, you know, there are many other scholars like Linda Tillery who know so much about this kind of evolution of black music. So I looked to Linda Tillery as a teacher in that area. I'm certainly not as well versed as she is, but, you know, I have learned from listening to her and her musical performances and the groups that she creates. She has a cultural heritage choir that shows us how work songs evolved. And so I look to that to think about how the blues has evolved out of African-American culture and been a staple then in our culture for transmitting our history. It has a great history of transmitting our culture and our past. So I feel, you know, the blues could be a whole series of plays, you know, based on blues songs or blues characters. And this is just the tip of the iceberg and how blues has maintained us over time. and has evolved. And of course, nobody, you know, in the early days, early black Christians thought the blues was, you know, devil's music, when of course it's all just music. I mean, if one believes in the devil, then perhaps you would think that. I don't believe in the devil. But it's a music is in and of itself is just music, and it's what we do with it. So that's why one of the lines is the blues aren't always blue. Is important to me, because it tells you the music is what you make of it and how you can use it. And Alberta used the blues as a way to express her emotions and express her history. So it's an interesting, I mean, for me, you know, I grew up actually with my great-grandmother. And my great-grandmother was born to an Indian father and an African-American mother in Iowa. Okay. And she came to New England as a young person. And in New England, in Boston, she married another Native American in the early part of the 20th century. And one of the great sadnesses for her was that she was cut off from her Native American culture at a young age.
Oh.
And to some degree isolated from both African American culture and Native American culture when she was living in Boston, because she was not from the same tribe as her husband. So it's a very, you know, so in many ways she lost a lot of her culture. She wasn't able to transmit it except through a few personal stories. And so the cultural heritage that she lost, she kept the tiny thread and she passed it down to her daughter, my grandmother, and her daughter, my mother, and me, through her small stories. But I could see from that my own experience how significant cultural heritage is for people, and how the blues is such an important part of that for all of us, for not letting us forget about the oppression, the slavery, the poverty, and not just to think about it with bitterness, but to remember what we have overcome and what the possibilities we make for ourselves. And so that's what the blues is for me personally.
Yeah, I just think about Alberta Hunter and how I remember when Angela Davison's book came out, Blues Divas, and when I heard about Alberta Hunter, I wonder, well, why isn't she in the book? You know, because Alberta Hunter, she is a successful woman. You know, when she makes her transition, when she dies, she has an inheritance. She's not poor. She owns property.
No.
I mean, yeah, I mean, she did really well. And it would be great if more people knew her story, because it's so encouraging. You know, people think about being an artist and having a career, and she's a good role model about how a woman can do it well. You know, and she took like a break, and then she came back and still did it well.
Right.
Yeah. And you know, just like you, you're a working artist, which is wonderful. You know, you're a great model for, for how you can do what you love and it can support you. So I'm really happy. You know, every time somebody wants to, do an Ashe moment, like this great play for our dear sister Alberta Hunter. It's like, yeah, wonderful.
Well, yeah, I mean, she, and one of the things that I came to understand is everybody talked about Alberta like she was mean or bitter or tough or, you know, difficult. And the truth was she had to be tough in order to survive, in order to keep her music under her control. And the very same things that they would say were heroic in a male figure, as if he tried to maintain his dignity and independence, for a woman to do that, suddenly she's the B word, you know, because she's insistent upon her rights and demanding about her dignity. You know, suddenly she's the bad girl. And I think a lot of people talked about Alberta like that because she developed a very tough shell in order to survive in a man's world. And in many ways, she epitomized what a modern woman is still having to go through and then gets denigrated for being tough and paying attention and maintaining her independence. And the culture loves to dismiss you with the B word if you do not stay in your place. And Alberta definitely did not stay in her place. So she is definitely a Women's History Month hero for me. And her birthday is April the 1st, you know, this coming Saturday. So we're going to try to have a little birthday party for her at the show. And it's just, you know, I don't know why she, maybe because she stopped singing for a while before she came back, but we had the gift of her presence into her, you know, till she was 89 years old. She was sharp and talking and singing, so there's no way we should allow her to be forgotten. And there's a lovely film that was done. Roberts, this friend of mine, did a short documentary on queer blues divas.
I think it was at one of the film festivals.
It was at the Frameline Film Festival. I think it's called Queer Blues Divas. And
of the 1920s.
Yeah, right. And I narrate the film. And so it's a really lovely film.
I saw that film. I remember that. I saw that.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Take Nobody's Business, Queer Blues
Take
Divas
Nobody's
of the 1920s?
Business.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that was really good.
Yep.
Oh,
and it's,
yeah,
you know,
thanks for reminding us of that film.
Yeah,
sure, it's available. Yeah, it was released in 2011. Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's, you know, he has really tried to revive that history of these women who make an independent life despite all of the oppression literally that was directed at black women, so, and tried to undermine black women's success and independence. So, Take Nobody's Business is a really, really interesting door to open into that world.
I'll put a link to it here on the website, because I just found on the Frameline posted 28 minutes of it. So this is great.
Robert Phillipson was the filmmaker, and he's done a number of films, but that was one of the dearest to me, and I was very privileged to be to do the narration for that film.
I remember that. It was excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for this lovely conversation. Wow, that I totally forgot. And I remember, but then I forgot that Saturday would be her birthday. And do you, off the top of your head, know how old she would have been on Saturday, the 1st?
Like 120-something.
Well, that's cool. Wow.
Right, at least super
to see you all, if you all do candles. Like, how do you do that? Oh, that's so cool. Wow.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for remembering Alberta and praising my show. I feel really honored and lucky to have such a great cast and director and theater and artist technicians. I feel it was a true gift, and I just want to do Alberta proud.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure she would let you know if you weren't, right?
that's right. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Jill. You take good care.
Okay, Wanda, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. I was going to play something. Here we go.
Doom, 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 doom. Doom, doom.
Do. love.